Hi again, and welcome to the Community Broadband Bits podcast, a production of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. I'm Lisa Gonzalez. In this edition, we go to Kentucky and its state legislature. This past session, Kentuckians faced off with AT&T and its brainchild, Senate Bill 88. We reported on this piece of legislation in February as it was making its way through the legislature. The bill would have removed the carrier of last resort requirement throughout the state. The bill would have also eliminated the Public Service Commission's authority to hear and resolve consumer complaints. In short, the bill would have granted AT&T the ability to decide who receives a landline and the ability to walk away from landline service. Christopher talks with Mimi Pickering, Director of Apple Shop's Community Media Initiative, and Tom Fitzgerald, Director of the Kentucky Resources Council. The two describe the bill in detail and tell us how a coalition of opponents defeated it. It's an interesting and inspiring story, and it reminds us about the power of organized constituents who succeed against political rhetoric and misinformation. Here's Chris, Mimi, and Tom.
Thank you for tuning in to another Community Broadband Bits podcast. This is Chris Mitchell with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and today I'm joined by two folks from Kentucky, Mimi Pickering, the Director of Apple Shop's Community Media Initiative. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Tom Fitzgerald, Director of the Kentucky Resources Council.
Hello.
And I'd like to start, Mimi, can you tell us a little bit about Apple Shop and your program there?
Sure. Well, Apple Shop is about 44, 45 years old, and we are a not-for-profit media arts and education center located in the coal fields, and the apple comes from Appalachia, not the thing you eat or the thing you work on all day. And so we're really here telling stories of people from this region and training people to use media and arts and tell their own stories. And we have a radio station, community-run radio station that goes throughout eastern Kentucky and southwestern Virginia and a little bit of West Virginia. And we're really, really concerned about broadband policy, telecommunications issues, because we think they have the potential to really enable us to diversify our economy and do things that we can't do because we're in steep mountain terrain with, you know, the lack of four-lane highways.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Tom Fitzgerald, please let us know what the Kentucky Resources Council does.
Sure. The Resources Council is a nonprofit, non-governmental organization. We are a legal and technical assistance provider. We do assistance for folks who can't find or can't afford representation. We don't charge for what we do, and we don't take fee-generating cases. So we do, and we take no government or corporate money. So it's an entirely unsustainable business model. But we do, we do an array of issues dealing with environmental health, environmental justice. And we also do a lot of utility work on behalf of low-income and seniors and fixed-income folks. And so our involvement in the what we call lovingly the AT&T bill stems from that standpoint. We often deal with, you know, at the intersection of poverty and environmental or utility injustice.
You mentioned the AT&T bill, which is the main thing I wanted to talk to both of you about. We had a show a few months ago where we talked with Harold Feld generally about this movement by AT&T to try and deregulate its services, trying to remove consumer protections under the guise of demanding a change because of new technology. But I'm wondering if you can step back and if one of you wants to field a brief explanation of what this bill that was introduced in the Kentucky State Legislature was aiming to do.
Sure. I'll take first shot at it, and Mimi can jump in if I forget anything or miss anything. AT&T, this is the second year that they have attempted in Kentucky to complete the deregulation of phone service. Back in 2006, AT&T lobbied for and was successful in getting enacted a deregulation of everything in terms of telephony other than basic local exchange service. The representation of the sponsor of the bill was that basic local phone service, which is defined under state laws, 911, 411, operator assistance, interconnection, and free phones, unlimited dialing within the local area, and then operator assistance. That was remained protected, remained under the Public Service Commission jurisdiction in terms of reliability. And there were commitments or promises made by AT&T that if they were freed from this onerous burden of having to be regulated for their other services, that there would be this significant amount of additional investment in jobs. And there were these grandiose suggestions by Connect Kentucky, which was a private-public partnership, that by 2007 there would be 100% broadband coverage across the entire Commonwealth of Kentucky. Well, fast forward to 2012 and then to 2013, AT&T comes in with a new bill that would complete deregulation. What it would have done under the auspices of Senate Bill 88 is for the three utilities that elected to deregulate, which are AT&T, Windstream, which is both an incumbent and in some cases a competitive local exchange carrier, and Cincinnati Bell, which is up in the northern Kentucky area, that if their bill had become law, no new customer would have the right to demand basic standalone service. The Public Service Commission would lose all jurisdiction over basic service reliability. In areas with over 5,000 households, the companies would no longer be required to offer standalone service even to existing customers. And in areas with less than 5,000, they could either go to the Public Service Commission and say, there's a broadband provider here locally that's capable of providing voice service, or there's another unaffiliated provider that offers voice service in the exchange. The third option they had, which is the one that they were most likely to use, is they could offer a, quote, alternative voice service, which would, as part of a any arrangement, which means that they could say to existing customers, even in the smaller areas, we are no longer going to service your landlines, because that's consistent with where AT&T is going. They are essentially, as one person testified, a wireless company that bought Bell South. What they will be doing is migrating rural and high-cost customers to their wireless home service and then making investments in the landline and fiber optics in the urban profit centers. So that essentially is what they're doing. And this is consistent with what they're doing throughout the country within their service area, which is attempting in some respects to preempt what the SEC has been asked to do at the federal level, which is to sunset the publicly switched phone network and to eliminate net neutrality and to eliminate the obligation to allow competitive carriers to use their system.
And Mimi, maybe you can tell me why that's a problem. Why can't everyone just use their iPhone?
Well, it's a real problem in lots of areas in Kentucky because we, although we may have cell phones, the service is very erratic. And I know, you know, AT&T and some of the other companies use information that says, well, you know, 75% of households, I don't have the correct number, but a lot, you know, are using cell phones. But what they don't say is that, you know, we're also holding on to our landlines, such as my family does. You know, the cell phone, although there are two towers in Whitesburg where I live, which I can see out of my back window, the phone just doesn't ring. So I can't rely on it to get calls when I'm home. And then there are all kinds of issues with 911 services and people who are on medical monitors, all kinds of things.
Mimi, can you explain briefly what you mean? I think the point about the medical monitors is really important, and I don't know that everyone understands how this is interrelated. Can you push in a little bit on that?
Sure, and I don't understand it completely. I mean, this one of the things in doing this, Tom has been so great in investigating, and as well as other folks that have been involved in this loose coalition. You know, we've just learned so much together about everything that's connected. But people, you know, who are on heart monitors, diabetes monitors, there are different kinds of medical monitors. And so they are, you know, their tests, their regular data goes out over landlines. And I Tom may be able to add more, but I understand it's not that the devices have not yet been, you know, are not yet available everywhere to do this on a cell phone. And again, you would have the, you know, the irregularity. We also, you know, lose power in this area, as lots of areas of rural Kentucky do in storms. And, you know, when you lose power, you lose your cell phone, whereas a landline, you still have it. So that's another reason that they're really important.
Yeah, I think that maybe hit a couple of points that I think are very important points. Part of the reportage that that AppleShop did, which was so significant, is they did some investigative reporting on the issue and discovered that at the University of Kentucky, which is one of the major university medical centers in the state, they monitor a significant number of folks remotely, and they do so with an analog system on the copper wired network, and they are essentially using that system. Because of the high degree of reliability and functionality of the system, they are able to give these folks a remote medical monitoring that is the equivalent of being in the office with them. And so in a state that has 120 counties and has numerous people who are not able to travel the significant distances that are necessary in order to get the medical attention, this is literally a lifeline. And the problem, you know, the problem with saying to rural Kentucky, we are going to switch you out to our wireless home service rather than a wireline service, is that the wireless service is not only for medical monitoring, but for a number of other reasons, is not as functional. And so what you're basically asking most of, you know, rural Kentucky, particularly Appalachian Kentucky, is we are going to no longer service your highly reliable direct current supported landline here, and we are going to switch you out to a wireless home service as part of a package. So you're going to buy a package now because we're not making enough money on the basic service, and then you go to the AT&T website and you read their legal disclaimer on their wireless home phone service, and I think it says it all. They don't represent that the WHP, as they call it, is equivalent to landline service. They say that you may experience occasional service limitations, i.e. dropped calls. We recommend that you place it on a hard surface with an unobstructed view of the outdoors, so because you've got line-of-sight issues. 911 calls, it says, we don't warrant that we will be able to find you if you make a 911 call, because unless you've got GPS system in many of these areas, the 911 service is done for cell service is done by triangulating among three towers, and there aren't sufficient tower coverage to accurately identify. They say that the wireless home service is compatible with home answering machines but may not support a fax machine, alarm services, including medical alert services, dial-up internet, credit card machines, and is not compatible with some television services. So, you know, for many of the folks in rural Kentucky where there isn't effective competition from another carrier, what they're looking at is a degradation in the quality and reliability of the existing service.
And I think that one of the things that we could probably emphasize as well is that one of the reasons that AT&T really, really wants to get people off the wireline and onto the wireless is so that they can hit them with more charges, they can charge them extra for more bandwidth that are being used beyond certain limits, and just all kinds of other extraneous charges that are really going to hit people in rural Appalachia pretty hard, I would guess.
That's right. And a lot of folks either can't afford or don't want to be part of a large bundle. You know, they don't want a big cable package, cable television package as part of their phone. You know, they don't need all these other services. And the landline and the carrier last resort, all of this legislation has provided a low-cost basic phone line that works fine for many folks. It also, there's a profit guaranteed for these carriers. So it's not like they're not losing money. It's sort of a matter of them wanting to make more money. So we just don't understand why we can't continue to have landlines as they are, pay for them, you know, they make some profit. And then as they, if they will invest, and if we, you know, have competition, if we do have improved cell service, if we do have improved broadband, which everybody wants, once it's there and it, and all these safety issues are addressed, well, then maybe it does make sense not to have the landline. But we're a long way from that. And, you know, I mean, just, you know, we're just leaving people literally in the dark and, you know, without noise, I guess you could say, or unable to speak, you know, potentially if you take these landlines away.
Something like 20 states have already passed similar laws. I'm curious, how exactly were you able to stop it? Not just once, but they knew that this was going to be a fight because you'd put together such a great coalition. You know, AARP was involved, the American Association of Retired People. How exactly were you able to stop mighty AT&T and to get them so upset that, that one of their executives wrote a hilarious op-ed and that, just totally over the top?
For your listeners, Chris, one of the things they need to be aware of is that while there have been a number of states that had in some fashion deregulated some aspect of telephony, not all of them have done the same thing. There are some states, Maine being one of the ones that I think is most exemplary, have really put the burden on the carriers to show that there's no need for them to be carriers of last resort in order that the goals of the Telecommunications Act that were, you know, passed in the 30s and then reaffirmed in 1996 of universal access to affordable, reliable, safe service that interconnects and competition, that those values will be maintained even in the absence of a regulatory oversight. And so you have other states like Florida that are kind of the Wild West when it comes to deregulation, and then you have a lot that are in between.
The National Regulatory Research Institute has written all these up, and it's a fantastic report explaining some of these nuances. So thank you for bringing that up.
It is. And they're apparently coming out with a new report this year, but the 2010-2012 report that they did is an excellent summary, you know, and synopsis. What happened, and Mimi from her perspective can tell you, because her the groups that she is working with, the rural broadband folks, really were very important partners in this process. We knew going into this session that AT&T was going to throw everything that they could at it. They had hired over 30 lobbyists last year, and what was different this time is that they hired a PR firm out of Louisville, which funneled, I'm not sure if it was AT&T directly funneling or indirectly funneling, but funneled a significant amount of money into a group called Citizens for a Digital Future, which is incorporated as a nonprofit in Atlanta, and is AT&T is a part of it. You don't break down the 990 forms. Don't break down who contributed what for the, you know, in the public file, but Citizens for Digital Future opened a Kentucky chapter. The person who was running that is a PR person for a firm called RunSwitch out of Louisville. And they took a significant chunk of money and went out and did ads on the airways, as well as having some proxies write some fairly nasty columns about AARP having a conflict because they have a cellular service that they offer to their members, which ironically goes through the AT&T system. So we knew that there was going to be a lot of money thrown at this by AT&T. And what we had is a number of individuals who told some pretty compelling stories. We had a number of legislators in the House from rural Kentucky, and in particular Appalachian Kentucky, including the former Attorney General, who is now the Speaker of the House, who understand, you know, and a number of the legislators in the House, they understood that when the ice storm happened, that the only access people had in terms of communications, because the power was out, was the landline system that had its own independent backup power. And they understood that people were not being hooked back up to their systems in a timely enough fashion, unless and until they called the Public Service Commission and had them intervene. So, you know, it is probably the most difficult time we had was breaking down the effect of the bill. And because it is a complex area, it is somewhat arcane in terms of regulation. It spans, it spans a couple of different technologies. But I think that the legislators, to their credit, in the House and some of them in the Senate, understood that there may come a time where you can offer these essential services through another platform, whether it be a wireless or a wired internet protocol platform, but we're not there yet. And before you switch out the publicly switched network and take it private, essentially, which is what AT&T has asked the FCC to allow them to do, we need to make sure that these consumer protections stay in place and that there is no erosion of these essential basic services, which are all that some people want, all that some people, many people, in the fourth poorest state in the nation can afford.
And I think, there was a great coalition with Fitz just doing a masterful job of explaining and researching what this legislation actually would mean. I mean, I just don't think the legislators had any idea, particularly last year. You know, they just, well, it all just sounds like a good thing. Let's have better broadband, you know, let's have better Wi-Fi or wireless services. So in digging into it, he really could help these legislators understand what it really meant. And then also he wrote op-eds, other people wrote op-eds, and the news media in Kentucky was really picked up this story and did their own, you know, investigating and presenting different points of view, which was really, really helpful getting the word out. And then, citizen advocates such as ourselves and Kentuckians for the Commonwealth really kind of boiled it down to the simplest terms of this is what could happen. And I think citizens throughout the state really related to that. AARP did a good job on that also. And there were union folks that were concerned about it and spoke up. CWA was involved. So it was a really good coalition. And I think that's a key to having these kinds of victories in other states as well.
I think that's really true. And we did have some tremendous partners. And then we also had the competitive local exchange carriers who rely on the quality of the landline system in order to offer competitive options to customers, and they recognize that with the attempted switch, and the deregulation that AT&T has asked the FCC to allow, that the ability to interconnect, which is one of the core principles of the Telecommunications Act, would be at risk. And so because AT&T has said, they don't believe that when you go to an internet protocol that you have to allow interconnection. And so it was a great coalition, and I was privileged to be a part of it. But it really did take everybody. And so this is replicable in other states. It's a matter of getting a broad base of folks who potentially stand to lose by taking the telephony out of a regulated environment, and who are willing to work hard because, they're up against a significant chunk of money. We had, I think, 24 lobbyists on AT&T's payroll this time, plus they had the State Chamber of Commerce and a number of other folks that were attempting through campaign contributions, through charitable donations, and through lobbying, as well as funneling money into indirect lobbying and robocalls. They were trying their best.
I understand that there was a front group or another AstroTurf type group. Was there something along those lines that happened?
It was the Citizens for a Digital Future did the robocalling and seemed to direct it into Eastern Kentucky, where the House Speaker and the head of the committee that was hearing the bill in the House both reside and represent. And I got one of the calls. A lot of people I know around here got the calls, and they were very threatening. They were like, there are legislators in Louisville, in the big city, that are trying to keep you from having good quality broadband and cell service, you know, and actually named one of the legislators, which I think backfired because he was in leadership and got very mad. One of the ironies was they called all of us on our landlines.
That's right. And of course, that was the new wrinkle this time, is that you had, in Kentucky, lobbying, unfortunately, is only defined as direct contact with legislators. And that's the Legislative Ethics Commission has recommended that it be broadened in order to include advertising. And I certainly think it should. You know, we've reported any grassroots money that we've spent on advocacy for years and believe that everybody should. What happened is this group, Citizens for Digital Future, did a bunch of the robocalling, and then there were also at least one legislator told me that there had been threats that they would start a 527 to go after a super PAC to go after the legislators who were impeding progress. And so the tactics were very Rovian in nature.
As in Karl Rove.
You know, that may work in D.C., it may work somewhere else, but it doesn't work here. And it really did backfire. There were a number of very angry legislators who, and Larry Clark, you know, called them out in committee and told them how little he appreciated those sorts of tactics.
I'm curious if you can offer some advice to others who may be doing this. And in particular, I'm not surprised that you found legislators were willing to listen and they were interested. And I'm very glad that you had people who were able to take a very technical regulatory subject and explain it. But at the same time, there's 100 legislators or more, and there's one of you. I'm curious if you can give a sense of how one can go about trying to have these one-on-one conversations at such a large scale.
Well, I think that there are a couple of things. One is you don't try to do it yourself. And I think that, as Mimi said, there was a broad coalition of folks. AARP was actually able to go toe-to-toe with AT&T in terms of taking out some print ads. We were able to utilize the op-eds, there were some news services that picked up the story, we also had WMMT, which is Apple Shop Station, doing radio coverage. So you rely on the publicly available media, and you rely on Facebook and other ways, social media, that are available, that are accessible, that are very affordable. And you use your existing networks. You build those links between, we had a very strong link between labor and seniors, because the CWA, the communication workers, they saw what happened with the promises that were made to them back in 2006 when everything else was deregulated, and what they've seen is a degradation of landline service and layoffs. And so it's a matter of getting a broad base of coalition, and there's lots of information out there that people can access. Bruce Kushnick at the national level does some very good analytical work on what AT&T is up to. You can get on the Federal Communications Commission website and read their petition, and then read the petition from Public Knowledge and from from NARUC, the regulatory commissioners, so that you can get up to speed on it fairly quickly. And of course, the NRRI study that you're going to do a link to, that'll give you the base that you need. And then there's always, we're always available, and I know AARP is, and I'm sure that the rural broadband folks would be available to assist in any state that's necessary in terms of attempting to assure that the legislative decisions are grounded in a full understanding and are grounded in truth rather than rhetoric about how we need to update the telecommunications system, and there's going to be $14 billion of investment, and you're going to lose out on the investment if you don't do so. it can be done. It just it takes a lot of it takes building those alliances and it takes working all of those different aspects of the issue in order to halt this kind of a juggernaut.
And I do think, you know, these are issues that really affect consumers as well as seniors. And so there are consumer advocates out there. And you know, in many places, they're already pretty conscious of these issues. But they, you know, they really need to be notified and, you know, and get ready. And they've got a real job to do in protecting citizens in their states. Kentucky, we also have a good statewide grassroots group that does a lot of environmental policy work, but also economic justice. And so those folks, they lobby as citizens in Frankfurt. And we also, our legislature does make it pretty easy to call and leave messages with a toll-free number. And so we encourage people to do that. And, you know, I think it still has some impact, at least on some legislators. And if they hear of enough constituents, which I think they did hear from a lot, particularly in rural areas, you know, they know that these people vote and, you know, occasionally they have to do the right thing.
One of the other groups that people can contact that that Fitz, you mentioned, was the Rural Broadband Policy Group, which is where Mimi, you and I originally met. That's part of the Rural Assembly, and so those are some excellent people to get in touch with in the, regarding
these
issues.
Right, and those folks are you know well connected with the Washington D.C. the Beltway policy people who were also very helpful. You know, there's a lot of expertise there and people that are really willing to share, you know, what they know with those of us out in the states, and so that's another great part of a coalition.
Yeah, and the last part that I don't want to forget is the competitive carriers who were running the risk of losing access to reliable access to their customers also were very helpful. And because a lot of, you know, because while this was billed as being a matter solely relating to retail service, it was in fact affecting wholesale service, carrier to carrier issues, and that was something that they understood. And so I was, and we, you know, while the State Public Service Commission was neutral on the issue because their view was that the legislature makes the policy decisions and they implement those decisions, we were able to ground truth all of the analyses that I did by sending it over to staff there and saying, would you please look this over for accuracy? So, you know, we prize that accuracy because, you know, this is not an area where you want to meet hyperbole with hyperbole. You want to let them rant all they want to, let them talk about the digital future and how we're trying to hold them back and put little cute little pictures of rotary dial phones in the papers and accuse us of wanting to chain everybody to a rotary dial phone. We'll stick to the facts and make sure that we're accurate and make sure that the legislators understand what's behind all of the rhetoric. You know, Chris, one thing that I haven't done yet but we were thinking about doing is, you know, not wanting to be outdone by the Citizens for a Digital Future, we were thinking of starting our own organization. And I understand that from the Secretary of State's office that it has the name is available, and it's Citizens for More Than a Middle Digit in Eastern Kentucky's Future.
Yes, I'm not surprised that that is available.
Yeah, it is a little long. I mean, we might have to shorten it a little bit. So,
well, at least you know what the graphic would be.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
That's terrific. Well, thank you so much for both coming on. I mean, I think this is terrific. It's a reminder of what can happen when we organize and we work really hard toward a necessary goal of preserving something that's so important for the entire society.
Sure. Well, thank you for having us.
That was Mimi Pickering from Apple Shop and Tom Fitzgerald from the Kentucky Resources Council. We have detailed information about Senate Bill 88 and its defeat on muninetworks.org. Follow the Kentucky tag. Learn about Mimi Pickering's organization, the Apple Shop Arts and Education Center, at appalshop.org. Tom Fitzgerald's organization, the Kentucky Resources Council, runs regular updates on legislation at kyrc.org. Send us your questions and comments. You can email us at podcast@muninetworks.org. Our handle on Twitter is @CommunityNets. This show was released on April 30th, 2013. We want to thank Mount Carmel for their song, O Louisa, Slow Blues, licensed using Creative Commons. Thanks again for listening.